now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. It's Thursday, and today we ask, will Roman Abramovich take his time deciding on Chelsea manager Frank Lampard's future? Elsewhere, West Ham aim for the next level under David Moyes. Is Paul Pogba on his way to a defining season for Manchester United? And Phil Neville swapped St George's Park for South Beach, but was he a success as England women's boss? To help me through it all, Jonathan Northcroft, Gregor Robertson and Tom Roddy. How are you doing, guys?
Thank you.
Oh, very well. Good. Great to speak to you. Not a great feeling for Frank Lampard at the moment, though, especially if you're a Chelsea fan. So let's start with them. We're going to get through a raft of topics today on the Game Podcast, and no time to waste. Two wins in eight Premier League games for Chelsea. Listen, I promised we would discuss the game at the King Power Stadium. It finished Leicester 2, Chelsea 0, but the Londoners were never really in it, and fans of the club were calling for the head of Frank Lampard afterwards, appalled by the performance. He certainly is, I think, on Roman Abramovich's chopping board at the moment. The Chelsea owner might not act as swiftly, given Lampard's status as a club legend, though. Johnny, before we discuss his future, what did you make of the game?
I mean, the starting point would be how good Leicester were. That could be, you know, and I'm talking about all Premier League performances. It's one of the performances of the season. The details of the football were so good. The off the ball movement, the ideas they had from set pieces. Every time a player sort of got the ball, it was a quick touch, and they had a clear idea of where everyone else was. You know, they played so well without Jamie Vardy firing. That eternal question about Leicester, what they do when Vardy's not there. Well, I mean, last few games they've been sensational, even though he's been off form. And from it was a very complete performance from a sort of coaching point of view. It had everything you'd want. It had the team's identity stamped all over it. It was also a big performance at a big moment. It was a game where, you know, they could go top of the league. And the question about that Leicester team has been, you know, can they take that next step, blah, blah, blah. They underperformed when they had a chance at Anfield early in the season. They answered that. It was fabulous. The most striking thing was against a big side, they scored a couple of goals and just kept them at arm's length. They were like Mayweather or something, just staying out of reach. And Chelsea couldn't land a blow on them. And you don't often see a big side just being kind of toyed with in that way. Leicester are getting better. And it's good news for the title race because they're a breath of fresh air in there.
Ominous for Chelsea, not just in terms of them and their performances at the moment, but their chances of a place in the top four as well, because it looks at the moment like Leicester asserts for that. Gregor, I wanted to talk about Chelsea's team selection, though. I was very surprised Frank Lampard started, especially Kai Havertz, in a game of this magnitude. You know, I expect the manager to pick the players he trusts most, and that really wouldn't have been one of the players I would have chosen. Timo Werner on the bench, okay, he's been misfiring. Tammy Abraham started instead, but also their approach, Gregor, because they seemed, and it might be because of the way that Leicester played, but they seemed off it just in terms of application, and that's rare to see from a big side.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that Lampard keeps coming out now, and he's actually starting to ring the same tune. He's saying the basics of the game are missing, and you know, the more you say that, the more you start to wonder how that reflects upon him. Yeah, I think. You know, I think there are some, you can look at some individuals, and as you say, are these players A, on form, and are they players you can really trust at the moment when there's a bit of pressure? I'd throw Hudson-Odoi into that. I think he's a brilliant impact player, and he's got wonderful talent, but to have him in a start in your starting lineup at this moment in time. I'm not so sure about that choice either. Kovacic was poor, but then the other thing, Reece James, he's kind of, you know, he's been brilliant going forward, but defensively he's not solid, he's not reliable, and Rudiger again you can throw into that too. So there are some sort of question marks over individuals, but the bigger question mark is the kind of their defensive structures and the amount of space and time that teams are afforded, and the way they can cut through the middle of them almost at will a lot of the time. And that, you have to say, that reflects poorly on Lampard. So when you're saying, you know, I'm just trying to put myself in a position where when I was playing, if you were on a team and you're thinking, I can't get close to them here. And sometimes it is there a buy-in? Is there a complete buy-in from the players into the way they're being sent out and the sort of the tactical sort of overview from Lampard? Are the players really buying into that? Are they seeing that this is the best way for them to win the game? I think there is an element of that, and there is an element of just individuals really not playing at their very best, or perhaps not being good enough. So, you know, I think the more Lampard says that, I think the more it kind of reflects poorly on him, actually.
Tom, do you think Lampard's now destined for the chop? We know what it's like to be in the hot seat at Chelsea. Managers don't get too much time to prove their worth. And from what we've seen since Lampard took over, do you think Roman Abramovich would be keen to extend his contract?
I think most managers who join Chelsea are destined for the chop at some point. But I think most managers are. But I don't think so right now. It's not a good position at all. But I think we've seen this. It's such a strange season, and we've spoken on here about Arteta going, about Ollie going, and Solskjaer's now top of the table, and Arteta's Arsenal are improving under the kids, essentially. And there seems to be so much kind of flux this season, and I don't think it doesn't look good. At Chelsea because of the way in which it's dropped off a cliff. But the middle of December, they were the ones who were top of the table. And I think you see the change that happened in the summer, the amount of players that came in. And it takes a while to transition that. I think the one thing Gregor was saying that also kind of rings true is the Lampard's kind of admitted recently that the benchmark has changed at Chelsea, and there's this suggestion that the top four would be okay this year, which surprises me a little bit. I think you'd still be aiming a little bit higher. But I think as well, you know, they've got Luton this weekend, they've got Wolves and Burnley next week. They're three very winnable games. You'd expect them to win those games, and it's possible. Three wins in a row, and you go into February on a bit more of a high and getting momentum, and I think it can still turn around that quickly at Chelsea as well.
I do feel it was a little bit inevitable, just the sheer number of young players that came through Chelsea's team last year, and look, you know, they've got big reputations, you know, the likes of Mason Mount, we've mentioned Reece James already, and we almost forget that you go back 18 months and they were playing for Wigan and Derby County, and they're still players learning their trade who have sort of big roles in that Chelsea team at the moment. And they're not the only ones. You know, you still talk about the likes of Tammy Abraham, Callum Hudson-Odoi. You know, these are people still trying to prove themselves really on the top level, and they're doing it at a top club. So in many ways, I'm inclined to give Frank Lampard just a little bit more time. But I wonder if in the summer there'll be a big decision to make. And if that, Johnny, that big decision has to come from Roman Abramovich, from what you know of him, do you think there will be more leeway for Frank Lampard, you know, given it's a man who made 649 Chelsea appearances and won 11 major trophies as a player at the club?
I think the leeway has sort of been used up. I think he, if he'd been Andre Villas-Boas, let's say, he may have gone already. And listen, I think it's right he gets that leeway. He's not only that club legend, he's a promising manager. We've seen that in flashes. We saw that at Derby. But I've got a feeling that goodwill is probably running short now from Abramovich. And I tell you what, it's always a recipe for disaster, if you like, for a manager when the owner invests big. When the owner spends big in a transfer summer and has particular players that they they really want to recruit. So, you know, Abramovich was a big fan of Kai Havertz, for example, wanted him at the club. Petr Cech is involved in the recruitment process, very close to Abramovich, has helped bring in some of those players, as has Marina Gravinskaya. So Abramovich and his team have spent, and the manager's expected to deliver. And I think that counts as much against Frank, or will count as much against Frank in Abramovich's mind, as the straightforward facts of the league position. I think when an owner sees that the kind of the hardware that they've provided isn't being used the way they want, it's very, very difficult for that coach to survive. So I think his reputation won't save him. I think it'll have to be results, and it'll have to be finishing in the top four. And I fear for him because it looks a long way off at the moment. It looks a difficult scenario. And it's doable, as Tom said. There's three winnable games. You know, it's a strange season. We could have said the same things about Arteta a month ago. But my gut instinct is they're not going to finish in that top four. There's too many issues. They're too far away from having an identity and a settled team that you could see putting a run together towards the end of the season to get into the top four.
There's no doubt, too, that the contrast of all those things you're saying with Leicester just kind of makes it more glaring. You know, Leicester have got sensible structures. The recruitment is just, you know, every year it's incredible. Fofana, again, was outstanding. Justin, you look at Justin and Chilwell now and you think, Justin could be playing left back for England soon. Absolutely. You know, they're kind of gradual progress, and Brendan Rodgers will be 2 years in the role next month, and you can see the steady progression. And he's one of the best managers in the country, and it's kind of you look at the kind of the two clubs as a whole, and there's no question which one's run better. And as you say, Johnny, that's true. When someone's kind of thrown £200 million at a team, and again, we've said this already, but you look how kind of imbalanced that was when they're still chopping and changing about who to play alongside Silva, and even Silva was an afterthought at the back. How they could have spent all that money and not signed a top class centre half or even a holding midfielder. You know, I know Kante's out, but that's the two areas of the pitch they need a spine. They signed a goalkeeper. They signed someone who they thought was going to be a top class centre forward in Werner, and I'm sure he is a top class player, and I'm sure he'll come good. But those are two glaring holes in Chelsea's team, and they spent £200 million and didn't come close to addressing them.
I wonder if they will with the likes of Declan Rice come the summer as well. But Tom, while we're on it, other candidates for the job, if Roman Abramovich does decide to change things around, are the club in contact with others, and who are those names?
Well, there's kind of talk of this suggestion of Germany and German coaches that would work, and which I mean, you can kind of see it in Czech speaks fluent German, so the hierarchy behind the club suits that, and you've got I think the idea again, as Johnny said about Abramovich and bringing in those German players who are seen as the future. I mean, Kai Havertz was in Germany. Kai Havertz is seen as one in a century player. That's how they kind of describe him. And Werner is the. I think the one surprise at Leipzig, funnily enough, with Werner was that he started so well at Chelsea in those first few games. They thought it'd take a little bit more time to settle in. And he's quite an emotional player as well. So it's, I think if Chelsea see the future around Havertz and Werner, then the idea of a German manager suits. And of course, we've all seen the brilliant work that Nagelsmann has done over the years. But I must admit, I mean, watching the other night, I thought how much Brendan Rodgers would, how much he deserves a job like that. I mean, I wouldn't leave Leicester, but how much he deserves an opportunity at a club like that and what his coaching style could do. I found it interesting this week to look back to 2012 when Brendan Rodgers was at Swansea, and he said that I wouldn't take the Chelsea job because it would destroy my career at the moment. And you look at Lampard's situation at the moment, if he gets sacked, what, you know, maybe that is the case.
It could well be. And I'm sure we'll be discussing Frank Lampard and Chelsea in the coming weeks to see if they can turn things around and fight their way up the table. Let's talk now about another manager who's fought back from a difficult situation. He's finally returning, I think, David Moyes, to being the manager many believed he always was, despite the difficult times he's had since going to Manchester United. West Ham are having a resurgence. They beat West Brom 2-1. They move now just 2 points outside the top four. 32 points after 19 games is their highest points tally halfway through a Premier League season. And the manager believes his club could be and should be competing at the top end of the Premier League, although he's saying he wants to take it step by step. Tom, where do you think Moyes can take West Ham as a club?
I think he has spoken about Europe recently, and at the moment, that feels a little too much of a stretch, and nothing to do with particularly West Ham's kind of potential, but I just think it's so populated at the top. You think about how well Southampton are doing at the moment, and clubs like that who are overachieving as well. It's going to be tricky to get into those European places. I've just been so impressed by the way in which he has so quickly built a culture at West Ham. And Johnny was talking about the kind of identity earlier at Leicester that you see. You feel like you're seeing that at West Ham under Moyes as well now. I mean, this feels like the recovery of his career, and it's been a long time coming from that Man United period. But the way in which he's sort of transformed them, transformed Antonio to be a striker. He's a good coach and a level-headed coach and a good man manager as well. I think the talk of Europe is a little bit of a stretch at the moment, but they're just so difficult to beat, and that is the foundation to start from.
Johnny, they're in the market for a new striker at the moment, West Ham. Investment is probably a worry word for West Ham United fans because it isn't as consistent, let's call it that, as a club like Leicester. And a lot of the time, they don't spend big money. So, and I think at the moment in the Premier League, you'd say if you want to be in Europe, that's something you might have to do. Do you think investment is what holds West Ham United back in many ways?
I do. I mean, it's not just like scale of investment. It's actually the way investment has gone over the last few years. I mean, they've been an odd club under the sort of ownership where they go through periods of not spending and selling decent players. And then suddenly they splurge 100 or 150 million on a bunch of guys that seem to have been, you know, bought from some kind of fantasy football catalog, but maybe not the A catalog, the B catalog, if you know what I mean. And you know, they were in the summer, they were selling Diangana behind Moyes' back, as it were. They were saying there was no cash around. Now I'm led to believe there is a willingness to try and spend again, and it's, you know, what Moyes' job is to make sure that they don't sort of just go into this boom and bust thing, and that money is used carefully and wisely. And you know, the striking position is the big one for them. They've offloaded Haller to Ajax because he's just, you know, for all his qualities, wasn't going to really be a consistent Premier League scorer. Antonio has done such an incredible job, but Antonio's in his 30s. He's such a team guy. He runs his socks off. He can't carry that workload all the time. So they need someone else. And striker's the hardest position to find. But the way they're playing at the moment, if you could imagine a striker in there, where could they go? The funny thing is, I think when David talks about moving to the next level, he's talking about becoming Everton. He's talking, that's the blueprint. He's talking about not jumping to the top four straight away, but building towards it. And I guess there's a lot that's similar about the Everton team he built. But with that Everton team he built, he for years didn't have a striker. That was one thing that kind of held them back, and he had to find solutions like Fellaini or Cahill and so on. And watching West Ham, there's so many echoes of what happened at Everton, including the sort of striking position one. I don't know, maybe they just need someone to come through the youth team, because as I say, I can't see them spending £80 million on a striker, and you know, golden strikers aren't around. But my goodness, they're so solid and structured and motivated that if they just had that extra player, I think they would be capable. Like a Raúl Jiménez with Wolves, you know, think of them like Wolves. Put Raúl Jiménez back in the Wolves team; they're a different kettle of fish. Take him out, and they struggle. And I think a striker could put West Ham that extra level in the same way.
I think we need to give Moyes credit though for the recruitment he has done.
Totally,
and he kind of wrested control of it as well, because that was the problem. It was, you know, Pellegrini had a kind of partnership with the director of football, and that was a disaster. And since he's come in, Jared Bowen, brilliant. Kufal, superb. Suchek, brilliant. Darren Randolph's a good goalkeeper. Craig Dawson's been a brilliant signing from Watford in recent weeks since he's got into the team. You know, Benrahma. So he's kind of, there's a couple that have got the, although it's in a different league now, and that you have to spend 20 odd million for a gem in the football league, as they used to call him when he was signing Tim Cahill and stuff. You know, he's still willing to do that. Benrahma, Jared Bowen, two players who certainly, if you ask anyone who followed the championship, you would be certain. You know, Benrahma's not done what Bowen has yet, but I'm sure he will be a really good Premier League player for them. The striker is the kind of the last piece in the puzzle at the moment, because, you know, he's also eased out Mark Noble, and they look really solid. Declan Rice and Suchek in midfield there. And Antonio's kind of injury record is the worry, especially as after Haller's gone. So they have no backup, really. And his kind of struggles with hamstring injuries mean they do need a striker, and I'm sure they will sign one this month. But so far, Moyes hasn't really hit a bum note in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, Gregor, you're right to point out that recruiting. And again, the echoes of Everton would be, you know, this is a guy that got John Stones for £2 million, Cahill for £2 million, Arteta for £2 million. I think if West Ham are able to entrust the process to Moyes, they'll be all right. It's whether the outside influences come back in. Suchek, to me, is one of the best bits of recruitment in the Premier League in the last couple of years, and a really interesting bit of recruitment. And what it makes me think of is Virgil van Dijk. I'm sorry, I'm not comparing them as players, but you think of Virgil van Dijk coming from Celtic to Southampton. You know, I spoke to a guy called Salvador Carmona about this. He runs DribLab, which is a data scouting company, and he pointed out that if you're looking for value, go to a league where there are big clubs where the players have to play under pressure, but it's not considered a great league. But those clubs, you know, are major clubs that play in Europe and so on. So if you can go to Celtic, for example, Celtic and Rangers in Scotland, or you go to the Portuguese clubs where there is pressure playing for Porto and Benfica and all that kind of stuff. In a similar way, go to Sparta Prague, go to the Czech league, where it's not considered a great league, but as a captain of Slavia Prague, there was Suchek playing in the Champions League, best running stats in the Champions League, captain of the Czech team as well. A real value signing, because all that was holding him back was the league he was playing in. And Kufal's followed from that league. And that's a type of value that Moyes is able to get, and his record from the Championship as well. I hope they just stick with that.
There is one small part of me that thinks, If there were fans inside the London Stadium at the start of the season, whether it would have gone as smoothly, let's call it that, for David Moyes, because I remember they were up in arms about the sale of Dean Garner to West Brom, for example, and we know they don't like going inside the London Stadium full stop. They hate watching football there. So when they return, Tom, do you think the West Ham United fans will be smiling?
Yeah, because of where the team are. I do. I think what the results weren't going well, and the stadium just doesn't help. But I think when results turn around and when your team's winning, that's the thing that gets fans on side. If it's all, you know, their big gripe was that they were promised they were going to the London Stadium to be a bigger club. if they come back, and when Moyes took over, they're in the relegation spaces. So if they come back and there's talk of Europe and realistic talk of Europe, then you're fulfilling expectations.
There's no doubt, though, that the atmosphere in those early weeks, because there's probably still some of them that are still not fan of Moyes because they have a feeling that there's a West Ham way and there's a kind of an obligation to play a certain brand of football, you know. And as Tom says, at the moment that will be dissipating a little bit because they're winning games. If they go on a sticky patch or sticky run of form, then you know those grumbles will no doubt come to the fore again. But those first couple of weeks, absolutely, they would have been much harder to navigate with all the noise around Diangana and Moyes' football and whatnot. But thankfully, they were able to. You know, I think all of us were really. None of us saw this coming. I certainly didn't. I didn't see. Maybe Johnny would. Johnny's a big fan of Moyes. I know that. But I thought it was looking like a tough season for them, particularly because, you know, there was a lack of investment and were they going to get a few signings over the line. But the signings they have made have improved them enormously.
And also the first game of the season was when they were awful against Newcastle. Yeah. And again, you wonder whether fans in the stadium then, whether that would have turned. But without them, it's helped, it's benefited.
Well, hopefully they'll have a lot to smile about and David Moyes will continue his good work. What a connection this is, though. Their former manager, Sam Allardyce, in charge of West Brom, of course, took over from Slaven Bilic as well. Before that defeat to West Ham United, Sam Allardyce was remarking on the fact that he'd left Robert Snodgrass out of his squad entirely for the match against his former team, West Ham. And he implied quite strongly that there was basically a gentleman's agreement between the two clubs when Snodgrass was signed earlier this month that he wouldn't take part in this fixture. And the Premier League are now investigating that. Gregor, from your playing career, have you ever seen this happen?
No. No, I mean, you get gentlemen's agreements and loans. They don't always actually, in my experience, tied, you know, write it into the contract that you're not allowed to play against your parents' club. Sometimes that is a gentleman's agreement, but certainly not on a permanent move. And, you know, it's just interesting the way it's come about and that if Sam hadn't said anything, you know, we'd be none the worse. Well, I don't know, would we? There would have been questions asked and I suppose he would have had to kind of straight bat them and say he was injured or something. But well, clearly they weren't going to get the player signed until after they'd played this game. That was the stumbling block. So they came to a mutual agreement that, you know, we'll sign him now, but we won't play him in that game. And so they could have him against Wolves in it. And he was good against Wolves. So, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. It seems like clearly a rule has been broken, but also I'm not entirely sure it's the biggest big deal in the world either, because he wouldn't have signed otherwise.
There is precedent for it. It happened in and just you saying about a rule being broken, it happened with Tim Howard and United and Everton. He was on loan to Everton from United and then signed and could have played against them. This was 2007, I think, and could have played against them and didn't because of a gentleman's agreement. Same thing happened. Premier League investigated and found no wrongdoing. So
good luck in getting somebody now to admit it. You know,
we already have.
I know, but yeah, but you'll roll back on that, and they'll need somebody. You know, they'll need both sides to come forward, and so I think it'll probably be blown over in a few days.
It's a funny one though, isn't it? Selling a player because they're not good enough to play for you, but then you don't want them to play again.
Yeah,
I don't understand that.
I don't know if there will be ramifications for this, but yeah, I think after Sam Allardyce's record of telling people how they can and cannot get around things, this probably wasn't the best thing for him. But there you go. We'll see if there are any ramifications for West Bromwich Albion or Robert Snodgrass or Sam Allardyce for that matter. And you can read at the moment Gary Jacobs' piece on the miracle worker, he says, David Moyes in the Times right now. Get yourself a digital subscription to the Times and Sunday Times, and you will get yourself 1 month free. Go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get yourself started.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, it's time to take a trip north now to Manchester, where United beat Fulham to go top of the Premier League just a couple of hours after City were briefly top after their 2-0 win over Aston Villa, which included a case study from the professional refereeing final exams. We'll get to that in a few moments' time, but we'll start at Craven Cottage, where an incredible Paul Pogba goal won the game for United, and I was there. He was an absolute joy to watch. He is technically on another level. He toys with players. His touch is perfect. He has every pass in the book. And it has always been for me about application, whether he could do that consistently. He's got the talent, we know. It is just about him showing it. And Johnny, finally, it seems like he is showing it. Do you think he's going to reach that potential that everyone has spoken about for so long in a United shirt?
Goodness me, I hope he does, because the Paul Pogba of the last few weeks and last night I watched the game is just a sensational amalgam of power, skill, football brain, leadership, everything you want in a player. This is a guy that they hope they'd signed. It reminded me what he did last night. I remember when Pogba was coming through at United, I remember people saying, you've got to see this kid in the youth team. And watching a couple of games, you know, bits of MUTV footage, and you'd see this sort of, you know, this powerhouse midfielder who was just bigger and better than everyone else, sort of barging everyone aside in midfield. And then he'd pop up on the edge of the box and bend one in from 20 yards. And you'd go, is that the same player? Can somebody do both of those things? And that's the player we're seeing at the moment. I think application is, there's a nuance to that, because I think it's more inspiration. I think he needs to be inspired by the team around him and the situation he's in to reach those heights. I think he's always tried hard, but maybe that extra level of, as I say, that last sort of bit of bite or sharpness comes from inspiration. Solskjaer keeps talking about how important it is to get Paul fit. He said it again last night. Every post-match interview recently, he's talked about Paul being fit. And I also wonder whether, you know, we know he had COVID early in the season and it took him a while. But I also wonder with him, given his size and how the skills that he's got to execute them under pressure, you know, it's difficult when you're that size. And I just wonder if he's one of those players, a bit like Wayne Rooney was, that needs to be, you know, he's got like a fighting weight. He's got to be absolutely on it. And even if he's a pound heavier or he's done a session less training, he's not quite going to be there. Because I think Solskjaer's trying to tell us something with that. But certainly in the condition he's in, mentally and physically, this is an unbelievable player.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that. I think after the lockdown and COVID, he did come back slightly out of the shape that we would expect him to be in. And yes, he is getting there. But look, I think he's a player that can do everything. And people can raise their question marks over those other nuanced things that you mentioned, like mentality maybe, Gregor. What do you think of Paul Pogba? Can he elevate this Manchester United team to being champions?
That's the huge question mark. I personally wouldn't be getting too carried away. I think he's had hugely decisive moments against Fulham, against Burnley, mm-hmm. against West Ham. So yeah, he stepped up in those moments. He's been, but there's been other moments, parts of the game where I know everybody enjoys to watch, but it still baffles me when he has the ball in a promising area and he's got a simple pass, which is the right thing to do, and he tries to hold someone off and toy with them. Like, he still does those kind of things that, for, you know, I know that's something that people like to watch, and it's possibly, you know, you could say it's kind of, he's having fun on the pitch. That's great, but sometimes he'll lose the ball and he'll give it away and do that. There's still things about him that drive me mad, to be honest. And we've seen patches of form like this. We've seen them in his time at Manchester United. He needs to sustain it. If he plays like this for the majority of the rest of the season, there's a chance he'll help Man U win the league. And then you go, crikey, this is the player, yes. But he's played probably 6 or 7 good games in a row. I wouldn't be getting too carried away yet, personally.
You raise a good point. For me, there's always been two types of central midfield player in a way for me. There is a central midfield player who every time you see them, they're in an ocean of space. And there is a central midfield player who is combative or sort of in bodily contact with other players often, you know, in that midfield area. And I'm always more scared about the ones who are in contact with other players because I always feel they're more likely to lose the ball in a central midfield area. I just think Paul Pogba has that ability now that if he uses it wisely, he can take Manchester United onto another plane. And I actually think he's been pushed into this position by the arrival of Bruno Fernandes, because I think it's helped take some pressure off of him on the pitch, off the pitch, in the way that the media react to why hasn't Paul Pogba performed? Why are Manchester United not winning games? I think Fernandes has helped take his name out of the headlines as being maybe a bit of a scapegoat for Manchester United. But I also think in many ways it's relaxed him to know that there's more quality around him, and that takes the onus off him to sort of run the game, and that means that he can have more decisive moments. Go on, Johnny.
Well, he clearly likes playing with Cavani too. If you look at their body language together on the pitch, and that feeds into what you're saying, Hugh, I think he enjoys playing with players who he sees as being at that level. Gregor makes a very valid point about judging things too quickly, because we have seen him dip in and out of form before. But, you know, everyone comes back to what he does for France. And I'd say over the period of his French career, he's been very, very consistent. And I guess the pro Pogba argument would be that is the player that he is when he's in the right environment and he feels right about where he is. So he can achieve consistency if he wants to, I suppose, which maybe goes straight back to Gregor's point again. But this is a moment. This is a key moment. You know, which way is Paul Pogba going to go in the next couple of months, and that will determine which way Manchester United go, and probably which way Paul Pogba was remembered in the Premier League.
Absolutely, I think that's absolutely right. I think if he kind of maintains his form, he keeps stepping up, and kind of, as we say, you know, having these decisive moments that win games for Manchester United, looking dominant in spells and games, and you know, enough spells and games. No one can do it for 90 minutes. If he does that between now and the season, you know, this is the first time I've ever said this on the podcast, Man United have a chance. They do, because he's one of their best players. There's never been any doubt about that. He just needs to show it regularly. So if he's shown it regularly and they have Fernandes on form and they have Cavani coming in and they have Rashford, you know, crikey, that's a stellar lineup. And for the first time you go, yes, Manchester United have a chance of staying up at the top end of the top of the table. But is he going to do it? He's not done it yet. That's all I'm saying. He's not done it yet.
I think it's belief. I completely agree with Johnny, the idea of being inspired. I think it's belief, especially when Cavani's playing. I think you see he brings a really nice balance to the team. He's this sort of traditional number nine, and I think he probably reminds him a little bit of Ibrahimovic as well, in the way in which he plays, the aura he has, the way he plays as a striker. And he just, instead of, there's always been that kind of hope at United, will Rashford become this 30 goal a season striker leading the line? Is Greenwood going to come through and be the Robin van Persie? And the irony was, when Cavani came in, it seemed like another one of those panic buys from United, a goal scorer who they hoped was coming to the end of his career and they hoped they'd bring in. But instead, he's actually been that kind of stellar signing, this top signing, this real goal scorer. And I think in Pogba, he believes that they can do it now. That's quite clear.
Tom, do you think he leaves this summer, no matter what?
I was thinking that as well.
No, I don't. Because I think they will end the season well. Even it will still be a good season for United. I think they'll get the top four, and I think it'll still be a good season for United. And he'll see that they seem to be growing and growing and growing. It seems incredible that, you know, what was it? It feels like only last week that Mino Raiola was saying he's gone. He's on his way. And it seems that was the spark point to this form.
I mean, he'll be 28 in March. I think there's a strong chance he'll leave in the summer, regardless.
His contract ends next summer as well, of course.
Yeah.
2022.
Yes. So, you know, there would be the kind of moment in time where if there's any noises again and there's any push from his agent, and the agent doesn't do it without his knowledge. It's nonsense even having that discussion. If there's any push again, then that's the moment in time where Man United could get some money back. And if he's helped them win the Premier League title, they may be even more willing to do it. If he hasn't, then, you know, I think either way, there's a good chance still that he's going to go. If he can go and play Real Madrid, you know, this is the time. If he signs another contract, it won't happen. It's very unlikely to happen. So this is the time. This is his time if he wants another big move and he wants to be a kind of Galactico.
Well, there's not a lot of money in European football at the moment, though. Real Madrid looks a natural place, has always looked a natural place with the Zidane link as well. But he's going to be very, very expensive. I mean, you come back to PSG as the most likely destination, and it'd be interesting to see him go into Pochettino's team and suddenly be asked to play a 90-minute pressing game or something like that. But yeah, his agent and him have clearly worked a position where he's got options this summer, put it that way. And like we've been saying, I just think it depends on the next couple of months. If he's happy, he'll stay.
We shall see what happens with the future of Paul Pogba and whether Manchester United can sustain their title challenge. One team that does look like they are going to sustain it, a Manchester City. They've now won 6 games in a row in the Premier League. And it was a fantastic game at the Etihad, especially for Villa's players after nearly 3 weeks off. But they were beaten, finished Manchester City 2, Aston Villa 0. Gregor, what did you make of the game?
I loved it. I thought it was like a proper throwback, you know, 90s. The pitch was descending into a mud bath. It was like blood and thunder, stretched, wide open. Although it was almost like the second half, it was like an FA Cup semi-final where Villa were like 2-1 in the lead and City were throwing everything at it to get the equaliser. That's what it felt like. It was brilliant. I think Paul Hirsch reported, he said only that crazy game at Man United and Leeds had more shots of any game in the Premier League this season. So, cracking game. And, you know, obviously Villa can feel very hard done by. We'll come to discuss that, I'm sure. But City were kind of, I don't know, they were still creating chance after chance, and they were back to their old selves. Again, they're still playing very well, but they're still lacking that kind of that killer touch a little bit. And, you know, we've spoken about this many times about who's playing centre forward for them and the absence of Aguero. So that's still an underlying kind of little worry, I think, for them. But Villa, you know, on the break, the brilliant chances, Traore's where he kind of plucked the ball out of the air from the goalkeeper's kick and cut inside and shot. That was one. Grealish was a threat on the break. Watkins chases everything in the channel and non-stop for 90 minutes. Yeah, I thought Villa could feel very hard done by. So, shall we talk about that crazy decision then?
Yeah, all right. Well,
what do you think about it, Gregor?
Well, I think it's kind of a bit, haven't I? I mean, what the hell is going on? There's a lot of rules really in football that aren't really fit for purpose, aren't there? You know, we talk about handball. I've talked about offside before on this. I remember it made me think back to City's Champions League semi-final against, was it Leon? And the goal where it was played, somebody dummied it through their legs. And you know, there was a, I guess, again, it's about who's interfering. I'm a defender, I'm biased, I was a defender. Anyone that's within your kind of peripheral vision influences your decision. It's hard. You expect someone, although this is an extreme example because he was 15 yards behind him and Mings saw the ball being kicked. It's very hard to ask a defender, particularly in a penalty box, when often these decisions are being made, to discount someone because they're over that side, they're out of they're not classed as interfering. It's very hard to ask a defender to do that. And personally, I think anyone who's offside should be offside. I think this is an extreme example of it. And obviously, we know that the rule was explained afterwards, and you heard Robbie Savage on the TV sort of suggesting that he, acting as if he knew that rule, which was ludicrous. I mean, no one did. Pep Guardiola said afterwards, "I don't know this rule."
Like, Tyrone Mings really said the same.
Exactly. So I think clearly by the letter of the law, it's the goal should have been given and it was given. But again, this is one of many laws that are not fit for purpose in football and they'll be illuminated in the last 12 months, probably with the help of VAR.
It just seems to be increasingly happening where you have something like this, which is outrageously wrong. And if that stadium had been full, everyone would have thought that isn't right. And it reminded me a little bit of, it used to happen quite often. I think Thierry Henry did it once, where a goalkeeper would be bouncing the ball or go to kick the ball and they nick it from them and put it in the goal. It reminded me of something like that, where it's not quite right. At the same time, I did think Tyrone Mings and Villa were still in a situation where they could have defended that. That wasn't a straightaway one-on-one keeper goal. They could still have defended that.
Yeah, he should have cleared it. I mean, these are obvious things. He could have defended better afterwards. He should have cleared it in the first place, although it's easy to say in hindsight. But he chested the ball, took one touch, and he was on him. It's not like he chested the ball, took a touch, looked up, and then it was pinched off his toes. It was like chest control tackle. He had no chance.
Yeah, look, this is one of the things that I think for me makes the rule ridiculous, in that had he challenged Mings for the ball coming out of the air, he would have been offside. Yeah, but because Mings tried to chest it down and then he challenged for the ball, he wasn't offside. I also think that the decision making for the defender was left at two extremes, because everyone is saying Tyrone Mings should have cleared it. But if Tyrone Mings ducked underneath it, Rodri would have been offside. If he just let the ball run straight past him and did nothing with it, it also would have been offside, because that would have been the ball uninterrupted carrying on. It wouldn't have been seen even as a minor secondary phase of play. But it is another example of people forgetting what the beauty of football is and what the spirit of football is, which is that I think we have a sport that became so dramatic and so brilliant to watch and got the whole world interested and loving it, because it's imperfect, because the rules were imperfect, because there was that sort of freedom for the referees to interpret it, that gave us the drama, the arguments, the debates, the opinions. And the more they attempt to make football perfect on the pitch in terms of the rules, the more ridiculous it becomes, because the sport, it's just not. You know, the beauty of it is its imperfection.
And I would argue this is them, I don't know, this is them trying to kind of over, what's the word?
Officiate.
Like, yeah, like, if offside's clear and simple and it's a line and anyone over that line, they've already tried to make it too complicated. You know, you could go back to making it very simple. And, you know, part of me thinking, you know, if somebody's standing out on the touchline and the goal scored on the other side, should it be a goal? You know, they're extreme examples like that, but they're also examples where a striker will run offside and that will influence the defender's position. And then he will hold his hands up or whatever, or start walking back, and then he can be classed as offside, but he's already influenced. Sorry, as not interfering in play, but he's already influenced the defender. There's too much at play for the defenders there, I think. It's similar to the one with the goalkeeper's vision as well, where, you know,
I was about to say that. It happened against West Brom this week for West Ham United. Fabianski goes to dive in the bottom corner. Colin Gallagher is in front of him. He isn't in his direct line of vision when the shot's made, but because the ball goes across Gallagher, Fabianski doesn't commit fully to the dive into the bottom corner, because Gallagher could have flicked it into the goal, and that way he can't get his fingertips to it, and that goal was still given. And for me, that's offside because it has influenced the decision making of the goalkeeper, who could have just thrown himself into the bottom corner and maybe got a save. Instead, he hesitated.
Sometimes the striker even kind of makes half a move towards it, and you know that as if that's not influencing the goalkeeper. He doesn't even know if he's going to touch it or not. It's madness.
We haven't even talked about the fact that play doesn't get called back anymore, that they let a move develop. And then the fact that somebody's been in an offside position means that move has an extra impetus. And in a new phase of play, they win a corner or whatever. I mean, without getting a bit too Arsene Wenger about this, I actually wonder if it's time to scrap offside as a rule. I think it was invented. Gregor's going to hate that as a defender, but it was invented in the 1920s in its current form to stop goal hanging. We're a totally different game now. Levels of fitness. There's no chance players could goal hang because it has to be an 11-man game in and out of possession. I don't know. It's radical, and I'd like to see it trialled before making a decision on it. But
it's nonsense, Johnny. It's absolute nonsense. I will not countenance the idea that offside is taken out of the sport because it's then a totally different game. I mean, you'll have 11 players defending the goal line. Yeah, it's a totally different sport without offside because you look, Gregor, you were a defender. If anyone can stand there 5 yards behind you, say, for example, if a free kick into the box, let's call it that, right? In this example, where do you set your defensive line then? You know, a ball out wide, getting crossed into the box.
Yeah, I mean, you don't leave much room for the goalkeeper to come and claim because this. Yeah, if anyone can run in behind you, you drop deep. You know, there's been analysis of this actually in Manchester United in the past week. And, you know, you needing to nick those extra few yards to compress the play and stuff. That's part of the kind of the beauty of defending, I think. It's like, you know, that's bravery. That's bravery stepping up and still. Because everyone knows. The defenders hate a ball over in behind them into space more than anything. So if they can't be offside when that happens, you don't allow the space.
I almost think managers will go 11 against 11 all over the pitch like it's five a side and just say, track your man. Yeah. That's the best way to defend.
The Elza wins a league.
What do you mean, yeah?
No.
That's ridiculous, Johnny.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it is nonsense, but I think we're getting to the point where something has to be tried. I can't see I can't see with a no offside game 11 men standing in front of a goal, because football's about space and possession and territory these days, and you'd just be giving the opposition the ball all the time, and you'd be consigning yourself to having no chance of counterattacking. So I don't know. I think levels of fitness, I think levels of strategy, positioning are such that we wouldn't see those types of games. But look, maybe I'm wrong. I'd have to see it in the flesh. I'd have to see it trialled. Or we go back to what Gregor says of just offside. We're in some kind of rugby territory at the moment where it's just administrated every week.
I also think that what a footballer is might change if offside didn't exist, where everyone would need to be, you know, it'd be total football.
Yeah.
Everyone needs to be both centre-back and centre-forward and central midfielder and winger. You know, it's just, look, the game would materially change. And thankfully, we're not there just yet. But all I would say on the final point on what happened to Tyrone Mings against Manchester City is, if the referee gave offside there, would anyone, either manager or any of the players, complained? And that for me is really where you think it must be a ridiculous rule. If our perception of what offside is can be so against the rule as it was and how it played out for Tyrone Mings and Aston Villa. Because I don't think anyone that watches football would have complained if the flag went up there, and we wouldn't have noticed it, would we?
By the way, the penalty was just as bad.
I would agree with that. I would agree with
terrible.
That. Again, you're talking about the rule, though. We're talking about the rules and about hand being above the shoulder. That's, again, it's a kind of, you're drawing lines where it's never that simple. It's never that straightforward. And you've got to talk about the distance, and you've got to talk about the area of the pitch, and yeah, I mean, it'd be tough being a defender these days.
It would be. The money would be all right, though, Gregor. So, you know. Got to take that as it comes. Look, there's another big bit of news this week that we've got to discuss. Phil Neville has left his role as England's women's manager. His contract was due to end in July. He's taken over at David Beckham's Inter Miami in the MLS, having won the She Believes Cup title in 2019 with England and finished fourth at the World Cup that same year. But he did lose 7 of his last 11 games in charge. Norwegian Hege Riise will be the interim boss until Serena Wiegmann takes permanent charge in September. But Neville leaves with a win percentage of 54%. Compare that with 64% of his predecessor, Mark Sampson. I've got to ask, and I'll start with you, Johnny. Do you think Neville was a success as England boss?
I think there was two parts to his reign, weren't there? I think the initial spell was a great success, and he made a bit of a culture change, and he brought in a mentality more of expectation and excellence and so on. The irony is he wasn't able to then develop it and see it through on the pitch. And if you took my legacy, and looking at it, the whole, I think the way it's ended is actually bad for the women's game. The fact that you'd leave a prize position like that to go to a struggling MLS club. I know it's owned by his friend and it's got potential, but in terms of everything Neville preached when he came in was about the status and how the women's game should expect the same levels as a men's game. You know, this is a great job. Playing for England's incredible. He hasn't lived that though, has he? He's walked away to go and manage into Miami. So there's a mixed message there. I think some players will remember him with fondness and he developed them, like Lucy Bronze, you know, helped with her career. Maybe some won't. It doesn't quite sit right, the departure, all in all.
I think Johnny's totally right. He sort of lifted excellence levels in terms of what the England women's team should expect and what they kind of have and the way they're treated by the FA to be on the same level of the men's. And that is kind of a big part of his legacy, which is a little bit kind of damning on what actually happened on the pitch to have that as your legacy. And I was surprised by the job he took, because I thought it was a step. The ambitions you assume are going to be the Premier League. So then why go to the MLS? It seemed a strange, what Premier League club will look at the way in which a manager in the MLS develops a team and think they can do that here?
I don't know. I think at times towards the end, Neville showed a little bit of disrespect to the women's game. He came out openly and sort of suggested it was always this job, you know, coaching England, by the way, was always going to be a stepping stone to a job in the men's game. That's pretty much why I took it. And I didn't think he was even going to get a championship job personally by doing that. You know, I assumed if he was going to go into coaching in the men's game, it would be in League One or League Two, frankly. The fact that he's got a job in the MLS is fantastic for him. You know, I hope he enjoys Miami. But I do think at times, even though he made those statements about women's football being level with the men and should be treated similarly, towards the end when it wasn't going badly and questions were being asked of him, you know, that veneer sort of broke, in my opinion.
I've been to a couple of MLS clubs. I went to visit Wayne Rooney in DC a couple of years ago, and the low level of facilities has got to be seen to be believed. You know,
I don't think that'll be the case into Miami, though. I believe they've got a massive new complex, and it's kind of David Beckham has gone full out on this. So, but you're right. It's a level where you kind of, as you said, you know, he might be looking at a job. He'd be doing well to get a championship job. So if you're going to get offered a League One or League Two job, or you can go to Inter Miami with this kind of prestige and all that, that's the level he's at. That's the kind of realm he's operating in. I mean, I don't think he's particularly impressive in terms of as a pundit, as what he's done as a coach. But he's had jobs for England under 21s, as Manchester United assistant, a Valencia assistant, he co-owned Salford. he didn't even apply for the England women's job, and now he's got into Miami. So meritocracy, it is not. But it's also, you know, then you heard Gary Neville on Sky Sports sort of defending him and saying that every waking moment is focused on coaching and football and becoming better at it. And, you know, I fully believe that. So, and he is Phil Neville. He is one of the kind of class of 92, whatever it was. Is it 92? So that's the way, you know, it's not his fault. It's not his fault. And I'm sure he does work hard. And, you know, I'm sure he'll work hard in this job and he'll try and make the best of it.
I suppose the positive is for the women's team is that they're getting an outstanding coach in Serena Weigman coming. It now opens the way for someone like an Emma Hayes or Shelley Kerr or whatever to take the Olympic team. You know, they've got Hege Riise coming in, who's got a great reputation. So they actually might, you know, maybe they needed this change anyway. For the players and for the team, it might be a benefit. I think the damage is just to the prestige. I think, you know, as you were saying, Hugh and Tom, he's just sort of undermined his own argument. The argument that with the women's game is as prestigious as the men, he's undermined that with this decision.
We were talking about how Frank Lampard and the credit in the bank that he kind of has and the relationship that he has with Abramovich. Be interested to see if it doesn't go well for Phil Neville, David Beckham, having that conversation at the end.
Listen, maybe there's a BBC documentary on the way. It wouldn't surprise me the links that Phil Neville has. It felt like a bit of an experiment, though, for the women's game, Phil Neville's appointment. You know, lots of people made out when it happened that it would raise the profile of the women's game. And it almost felt like a lot of the decision-making was around the focus and engagement that there might be in the women's team because someone like Phil Neville was involved. To hire someone who hadn't worked in the women's game before then as the England women's manager was a huge decision. Do you think that has worked out for the FA, Johnny?
Probably not, actually. I think they needed more commitment and success from him for it to truly work out. And I think I mentioned the appointments, Wegman in particular, they seem to have learned from that. They're looking now at who's achieved excellence in the women's game and going down that route for England manager. And I think that's entirely correct. So, you know, maybe this will be a short look back on as a short period, a little experiment that didn't work. Because I can't see them doing this again.
Gregor, what do you think? I personally thought defensively, he never really got a hold of his England team. And they were a side that was third in a World Cup and then finished fourth in a World Cup. And a lot of people said that meant that there was no real progress under Phil Neville. And I'm concerned about him even being a success as Inter Miami's boss because they have had a torrid first season in the MLS for them. And to have Phil Neville, who again, for me, has work to do, you know, if I supported that club and actually I would have put myself as an Inter Miami fan, given the amount of time I've spent in the city. And I was, I'll tell you, honestly, my cousin lived there. I used to visit pretty much every other year. You know, I was looking forward to this franchise for years. And then they called it Inter Miami. And my heart sank because I was just like, yeah, I mean, I hope he does well, but I'm still concerned that again, he's got work to do. And well, what do you think? Do you think he will be a success in the MLS? Because it's a particular footballing community.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things to go into that. He's got kind of a reputation to build. And as I say, every move, he's had a strange career after football. Every job he's had has, you know, first of all, alongside David Moyes, his old manager, then alongside Valencia, alongside his brother. As I say, the England thing was an experiment. This is because, you know, alongside David Beckham, his friend. So he has to make it a success. I don't know where he would go after this. Where would he go? Certainly in England, where would he go if this wasn't a success? I really don't know. So he has to make it a success. And I'm sure he's a capable coach. And over in America, perhaps even more so than over here, is kind of what he's achieved in the game will make him a bit of a, will give him some stature. So, you know, I don't know, it's hard to say. I think he also, clearly he's going to need investment, and I think Inter Miami will have investment, and it'll probably be quite a long-term project. So, you know, probably a thing where you ask in a couple of years and you look back and see how the club has developed under him.
Tom, can he be a top manager in the future? Can he improve and improve?
I kind of wondered the opposite of Gregor in a way. The fact that his kind of background and having managed the kind of women's team for a few years. To what would the Inter Miami players think of his career coming over and the success he's had? you know, would they feel inspired to think this is the guy who's going to sort us out? I think he's got a lot of work in these next few days and weeks to really set a foundation for where it's going to go.
Well, we'll see if Phil Neville can make a success of himself in the MLS. Of course, as an English manager, we wish him the best. And if he's not one day a future English manager, I'm sure he's a future Salford City manager, Gregor, to answer your question on where he might go next. But gentlemen, thank you for being with me for the past hour or so. Jonathan Northcroft, Tom Roddy and Gregor Robertson. Much to look forward to over the weekend. It's the fourth round of the FA Cup. Fingers crossed for a better game between Manchester United and Liverpool. We'll discuss that on Monday amongst a raft of other things, I'm sure. But remember to get yourself a digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times and get more of our award-winning journalism on all of your devices. Sign up today and get yourself 1 month free. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/the game to get started.
Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson, a weekly series of in-depth interviews with high-profile figures examining how overcoming the challenges of their early lives shaped the people they've become. This week, rapper and songwriter Professor Green talks candidly about being raised on an East London council estate by his grandmother, his drug dealing, and how his father's suicide made him re-evaluate his own life.
The one thing that I have in common with a lot of my friends who come from similarly disadvantaged backgrounds is that we all carry on, and at the end of the day, no matter what happens, if you're still alive, I don't think there's anything really left to do but carry on.
Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson. Professor Green in his own words. Now available as a podcast. Listen on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.